Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting extravaganza of orgasmic, fantastic action. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, injecting you with truth like steroids into your iris places. My very special guest joining us tonight is Santos Bonacci from UniversalTruthSchool.com. We're going to be talking about some topics here that are going to be challenging every preconceived notion that you've got and or belief you may or may not have been programmed with since you being enrolled in state education. And sometimes it pays to sit back and listen a little, try to be calm. Then you can actually hear what's being said instead of reacting to it and what you think is being said before it's even been uttered. Santos Bonacci, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vinnie. Much appreciated.
Now, you've been going through some hard times, bro.
Certainly have, brother.
You know, and it's not like anybody else kind of realizes what you're going through. I do, and that's why I got you on, bro, because I am seeing you be really upset. I'm seeing you kind of really not doing too well, bro, and I'm kind of concerned about you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So tell
good on
me,
you. Thanks. Thanks, brother. Look, mostly, some of my behavior, which I'm not going to defend at all, is reactionary. It's mostly reactionary. And I suppose my fiery nature is too responsive, and I have to learn and grow up and just not react. I get provoked. You know how the provocations come. And to me, they land on my lap as though some kind of evil, intelligent entity was directing them at me. But I've done some work. I've done a lot of work with some good people who have been coaching me and healing me and helping me. And I don't know whether I can say conclusively and definitely that I have overcome this this problem of reacting. So I think if I can stop doing that, I will not show my frustration. I will not show my anger. We all have anger, and it's easy for people to point straight away as soon as they see someone who is supposed to quote unquote not have this kind of demeanor in public. I don't know. I'm not perfect, and the people who are pointing are not either. So, but
well,
I do.
I'd like to add this example here. Have you ever had a fight with a loved one, ladies and gentlemen? You know, and maybe you were both screaming or something, and that you said something that you shouldn't have said, or you said something out of hurt, out of anger, but nobody else was around to see it. But so you and your partner made up, and it was all fine, right? But imagine that happened on air, or somebody was filming it with a camera, right? It's ordinary behavior that we all do, but as soon as you introduce a recording device, people think you're not dealing with an ordinary person anymore. You think you're talking with a great broadcast personality, as if this kind of thing. This is actually, in fact, one of the ways you can tell that somebody's actually human, is if they can do this kind of thing, but also realize what they've done and not make excuses for it afterwards. So that's really good, man.
Yeah, I suppose it is. It's not good though when you lash out and when you react like that and do behavior like that. I always would love to have to maintain the highest of standard for syncretism and the holy science which I teach. I've always said though that I'm not worthy of it, and I'm just the messenger. Like a little donkey that brings you, 100 bars of gold on his back, you wouldn't, reject that gift just because it come to you from a stupid little donkey, which is not really a stupid little donkey anyway, but you might think that. So, I'm carrying the message of the ancient ones. I've always been connected to the ancient ones. I don't purport to have anything new. I'm not original at all, and I do bring what the ancients taught, because I know for a fact that they were much more conscious. We are suffering right now at the moment through of a lack of that divine consciousness and spark that we once had, through the attacks of demon entities, demon controllers. And demons are basically just entities, creatures, thought forms, emotion forms, and beings that are service to self. Now, there's a big service to self culture on the planet today, and they are demons. You know, this is how Bhagavad Gita describes them. This is how the Bible describes them in all the sacred books. So in my work, I want to protect the people who follow syncretism from the teachings of demons, such as, you know, meat eating, gravity, general relativity, quantum mechanics, and all of this hocus pocus, honky, shonky, wonky, dodgy, bodgy, bogus pseudoscience.
So we can go through the list of these. You call them the big five. What's number one, and why is it not the case?
Number one's the globe, and everything pinges on the globe and the materialist explanation for our cosmology and the world. And you could go back to Aristotle, but I won't go that far back. He was the first one of these materialists who broke away from Plato and the spiritualist school, and really just founded the peripatetic materialist school, where everything is described, you know, in material terms, and they deny the spiritual causes. Whereas Plato was a spiritualist, a transcendentalist, and this is why Justinian closed down the Neoplatonic schools in the 6th century, along with other crimes that he did toward humanity.
Sorry, what's a Neoplatonic school?
The Neoplatonists were the new Platonic people who flourished in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century of this common era, 800-900 years after the great Pythagoras and Plato and Socrates, that trilogy there.
And, what did they believe?
What they did was they basically taught the secret teachings of Plato, which are unwritten. Plato, basically, what we have of his writings are all of his philosophical writings and theological. But when he went transcendental, Aristotle couldn't follow him and broke away and continued with a materialist paradigm. And the transcendental went underground, virtually. 400 years after Plato, there was Plutarch and Philo, and supposedly Jesus the historical lived around that time, and they were also intermediary Neoplatonists. But the Neoplatonists flourished in Alexandria, Athens, and Rome, those three cities, and Ammonius Saccas was the founder. Then there was Plotinus, probably the greatest of all of them, and Proclus, Iamblichus, Sallustius, Porphyry, my favourite of the Neoplatonists. These were the greats, these seven or eight luminaries of the Neoplatonic short-lived school, and they taught this transcendental science. And so they also were of the geocentric disc-earth paradigm. Of course they were, because it is pinned to antiquity. So let's call it flat earth. I don't like that expression, because it's not flat. There's mountains and valleys.
That is a point that I wanted to raise as well, because any reasonable person, even though you say flat earth, understands mountains and valleys or anything, but it's on a plane, right, an overall one. But so that's just a distraction, a BS argument to begin with, against it, as opposed to, you know, real scientific evidence, etc. But I've been thinking about this term flat earther, what's a flat earther, etc., and it seems a derogatory term to me. It seems like Holocaust denier to me.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a persecutory label to me. And I wonder, what can you call a flat earther if a flat earther is a derogatory title? You know, is there a PC version of this to go around? Is there a geocentrist?
Yeah, I would say geocentrist. And then you could call, I would like for them to be called stationary disc earthers. The Earth is stationary, there's no doubt about it. It's been proven scientifically in the 1800s. George Airy, with the Airy's failure experiment, proved it conclusively. Michelson-Morley, Michelson-Gale, Sun Yat, these great, great scientists.
I can also prove that the Earth is stationary because all my paper and pencils came from it.
Yes, it is. It's stationary. Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, but look, one example, Vinny, is let's take the heliocentric model of the flying Earth, spinning Earth model. There are four movements that we have to take into account. Not only the rotation on its axis, but the orbit around the sun, number two. Number three is we are flinging around the center of the Milky Way galaxy at 550,000 miles an hour, or let's call it 500,000 miles an hour, 500,000, okay? And then the galaxy itself is hurtling through space, who knows which way, which direction, at an astronomical 670 million miles an hour. So let's not worry about the 1,000 mile an hour rotation around its axis and the 67,000 mile an hour orbit around the sun. Let's just have a look at these bigger ones, shall we? The biggest one being I'll have to grab this phone and just connect it. There you go. That fixes that, doesn't it?
It's live radio, folks. You know we ain't faking it.
So if we are in fact travelling at, see, this is what we have to accept if we are globalists now, okay? And look at the word globalist, globalism, and you'll see who's behind the globe since Copernicus,
but
the Jesuits
also
were founded.
I wanted to note that also calling people who are like round earthers globalists also seems to be a persecutory term. Wouldn't you think so? Because the truth movement's got this entire consciousness about globalism, you know, the New World Order, the scumbaggery all of a sudden. But now to think that being labeled a globalist, I don't think it's a fair label. What would be the PC version of that?
Gee, I don't know, man.
What was it? The heliocentrists.
Heliocentrists, I suppose. Yeah, that'd be probably the best way to keep it clean. You
yeah.
Know?
So it's geocentrists versus heliocentrists. Okay. Versus flat Earth versus round Earth, which don't really seem apt. You know, if it's going to be a scientific debate, let's use the proper terminology. Is what I was, you know, kind of trying to get out of this thing. Because,
let's do that.
Yeah, because have you noticed it all descends into this name-calling and hurt feelings, but let's just talk about the stuff that's actually what we actually think and listen to each other.
Yeah, for sure. Keep it clean. Although bear in mind that not all geocentrists teach the disc plane Earth. Some of them are geocentrists with a globe ball Earth. So basically what we are finding now through evidence and proof and research is that all of these orbs, so-called, moon, sun, they're all disks, that they appear, it's an optical illusion that they appear to be spheroids, but they are not. They are disks. And I'll explain why they are disks after we give one example to show that we are not moving, stationary and immovable and firm. As all the scriptures say, the earth was built to be firm. So if we look at that speed of 670 million miles in 1 hour. So in 1 hour, we've actually hurtled through space 670 million miles. 670 million miles every hour. So let's take 10 years of our life, right? Let's factor that figure into 10 years. So you've got to add a couple of zeros to that, and you'll get the figure for how far we've moved in a decade. And when you look up at the stars, you keep seeing the same shapes of Orion, Scorpio, Taurus, Aries, Gemini. There's no parallax in the stars. Now, supposedly, all those stars are at different distances.
Sorry. So, what's a parallax? Because most people will think that that's a Green Lantern villain.
Yeah. Well, it's the angle that a closer object moves away from a more further object as you move. So you're in a train. The trees that are 100 metres away from you move quicker than the trees that you can see 10 miles on in the distance in the hills. So that's the angle of parallax. And so you'll see these trees closer to you. They'll shoot past at the same speed.
Kind of like if a jet plane like rushes right in front of you, it appears really fast. But if it's flying miles away from you, it appears to go very slow.
Exactly. And so if you look at Orion, you can find depictions of Orion in Egypt, in some of those caves in south of France. I forget the name of that town. I think it's the Lazac Caves or something like that. Lazelle, Lazac, I forget right now. But they've got pictures of Taurus and the Hyades, which is the head of Taurus, and the Pleiades, which is on the shoulder of Taurus. And they are at the same degree, the same angle, and supposedly these are 40,000-year-old pictures of Taurus. Now, those stars in Taurus, none of them are supposedly at the same distance. So 40,000 years ago, Taurus looks the same as it does now. So just from this, now, just from this very fact that we move 670 million miles every hour, just from that motion alone of our motion, we should see a change of parallax in some of those stars, some distortion. There's no distortion, there's no movement, there's no shift in space between the constellations. They're always the same on the ecliptic. They're always there, all the stars, they're always in the same position. Now, here's another thing to factor into it. Not only those four motions that I described and have explained already, but the fact that all of those stars have their own proper motion. One's shooting off that away. Another one's going off, ping, the other direction. They've all got their own proper motion. And so this alone proves that those stars are much, much closer than what they're telling us. And the distance between them is not that great. And so what we're discovering is, as the scriptures say and the Bible teaches, that the Lord, the Creator, placed the stars in the firmament. We're looking up at a firmament. We don't know exactly what it is, but it's made of crystalline substance. It's probably cobalt, sapphire, lapis lazuli, carbon, some kind of bluish kind of a carbon structure that is a dome-like vault above our heads and which contains the electrical sonoluminescent starry bodies in it. And so the fact that there is no parallax in the stars ever, ever, ever proves this. It proves that the stars are much closer to us and that whatever is moving is above us and not we. We are not moving. And so those who accept this and see the evidence align themselves with the most ancient of all traditions and the most well-performed scientific method experiments to prove that the Earth is, in fact, stationary.
Okay. And we have the other four false teachings. What's number two?
I would say number two would be the Big Bang, and then evolution, and then gravity, and then general relativity. relativity of Einstein. Gravity has been very, very harmful to humanity. I would recommend to folks to go to a YouTube channel called Theoria Apophasis. Theoria Apophasis by Ken Wheeler. Ken Wheeler has released a free book called Discovering the Secrets of Magnetism, in which he claims, and he has, I've seen all of his videos, that he is the first man in history to explain magnetism. He's done what Steinmetz, Heavyweight, Faraday, Maxwell, Tesla have not even been able to explain, even though they gave us many experiments and many teachings on magnetism. I believe Ken Wheeler is on the money. He uses what's called a ferrocell, which is like a glass with a ferrous liquid ferrous properties in it, and it reflects and shows you the invisible energy of magnetism. So he'll put a magnet on a table, for instance, and he will show you the what he calls centripetal divergent energy reciprocating with centrifugal convergent energy on both poles of the magnet. And so what he's showing is that magnets don't have poles, and what they have is reciprocating added convergence and added divergence at the poles. So what you'll see is a hypertrochoidal pattern, which is two-dimensional. It's pretty much looks like a vortex, black and white vortex, like a in the Freemasonic black and white checkerboard or a chessboard. And you'll see this spiraling out in a golden ratio ratio form. And three-dimensionally, it's basically just a torus field or a hyperboloid. So an hourglass field or a donut. Let's make it simple. A donut gives you a torus around the outside shape and a hyperboloid hourglass in the middle. So in the middle of a donut, there's always an hourglass, okay, especially in a tight donut with a very narrow center. And that's an hourglass. And so what he's showing is that a magnet has a dielectric inertial plane, okay? Now, dielectric means it's the opposite of electricity. It hates electricity. So it's diamagnetic, and dielectrical means it's not conductive to electricity. So every magnet has this plane, a dielectric inertial plane. And so the energies are moving toward counter space. And this is how he explains that gravity does not exist. It's just an effect of magnetism and dielectricity. You see? So he's saying there's only one field, and it's the dielectric inertial field. And so, and magnetism is discharging, whereas this dielectric field is charging. And so magnetism actually has a discharge property to it. And basically, it's the controller of the universe. It controls everything. And so he explains that electricity is a hybrid of dielectricity and magnetism. And so, but there's only these things. And so if you look at the work of these real scientists, you won't be polluted with pseudoscience, hocus-pocus rubbish, when they try to explain gravity waves and they claim to have discovered them just of recent, a couple of weeks ago. Well, Ken Wheeler was very quick to react to that and counter that false claim of gravity fields to show that what, in fact, they are speaking of is magnetism and the dielectric plane. And so the reason why we are, well, really the reason why we are stuck to the Earth and it appears to be gravity is because of the laws of buoyancy and density and mass. Has nothing to do with gravity, because we're not upside down in New Zealand. We're not upside down in Australia. We're actually, heavens are up, and what is down is down, and what is up is up. It's not relative at all. It is not relative, and science proves this. Science confirms this. Apart from this one example that I've given, I can give many, many examples, and one should stop and think, who is seduced by these big five teachings. These big five teachings are certainly promoted by service to self interest entities. There's no doubt about that. They've changed our cosmology and corrupted our minds, and they've really basically gone against everything ancient and traditional that has been like it has for millions and millions of years, and timeless science.
Well, let's talk about materialism itself then. What is it?
Well, materialism is connected to our animal material minds. We have two minds. We have a divine spiritual transcendental mind, which transcends the operations of our material bodies. And what are those operations? Well, instinct, survival, gross lustful sex, power hungry things. We are
the good things in life, you know.
Yeah, all the good stuff, huh? Yeah, but see, this is the thing, Vinny. We don't have to shun power, sex, and lust. We have to transmute them. We have to sublimate them. There is such a thing as transcendental lust.
I transmuted sex into getting married, and there hasn't made any sex since, you know.
Yeah, you went the wrong way, didn't you?
That's what she said.
Yep. And that's what a lot of married blokes will concur with too. No.
But it's absolutely not true. I was just joking. Anyway.
Yes, of course. The Creator. Now, I probably shouldn't be sharing these sacred secrets because it's throwing pearls to swine. Not to you or the listeners. These are good people and we all deserve this information. But in the Vedic science, they don't spill these great secrets. I've divulged many, many profound sacred secrets in my teachings. And probably, you know, the reason why I get a lot of trouble is because maybe I shouldn't have. But the lustful sex must be transmuted. Radharani, the Queen of Heavens, and her consort Krishna, the Prime Source Creator, in one of their names, they have many names, are always indulging in sex, you know. There's no end of sex. We are not here to stop this and stop that and eating and drinking and the quest for power. It's just that we should seek proper power to do good things, and we should be harvesting the good sexual energy. Not
what you mean
lust.
Is you shouldn't be questing after power. What you should be questing after is empowerment.
Exactly. Empowerment, to be empowered, self-determined, to be better, to improve. All of these material versions, which are like a broken mirror version of the true causal emanations of everything we see, everything we do, have their more brilliant and transcendental counterparts. So we have our own spiritual form. You see, when we die, our souls and spirits continue on because we are immortal, and they continue in their spiritual form. You see, there is form in the spirit worlds, and there are such a thing as spiritual planets, Vaikuntha, Vrindavan, Madhura, all of these places, they are described in the Vedic scriptures clearly that we will inhabit those abodes one day, should we be worthy. And so even the so-called planets, Jupiter is not a terrestrial planet. Mars is not a terrestrial planet. You can't go there with these bodies. You can go there with spiritual bodies. They are sonoluminescent, angelic, archangelic forms. And they are servants of the Creator and servants of us. And so the people that go there, the rishis that go to the moon, they are called lunar people. The rishis that go to the sun, they are called solar people. And these abodes are wonderful abodes. There are even seven subterranean planets. And the one below our Earth disk plane is called Atala. Now, Atala, if you know Italian and Latin, you will know that Atala is the first part of the word Atlantis.
Well, see, in New Zealand, we think it's a hazelnut spread.
Yeah, Nutella. Nutella, yeah. But Atala, A-T-A-L-A, is the first part of Atalante, which in Italian is Atlantis. And when they say that Atlantis sank, well, yes, it did, below the earth. You see, it's speaking about spiritual waters. It sank in the waters. Atala and Putala and all the other five other subterranean abodes, these have been recounted in all the scriptures that they exist. So we have seven planets under us and we have seven below us. Above us. So above us we have Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, in that order of spherical influence and position. And then below us we have Atala, Atalante, Atlantis. Below that is Vitala, then Sutala, then Talitala. And I need my glasses here, guys.
Yeah, see, excuse me. Well, I know you need your glasses. I could tell her.
Yeah, I could tell her. Mahatala, Rasatala, and Patala. Now, Patala is what's the very, very lowest of these seven subterranean planets, and they are called hellish. But the six above it, Patala is hellish, and the six above, they're actually called heavenly subterranean planets. But rest assured, they come through the center of the earth at the North Pole, some of the people from there, and they pretend to be good helpers, and they give us technology in exchange for little children that get taken, and who knows what they do with them. I think we have an idea because of many researchers that explain where these the extraterrestrials are doing deals with very powerful and elite entities on this so-called elite on this plane. And this is why you will always catch them with, at places of sacrifice. And we know through the researches of many that a lot of these children get sacrificed. Well, a lot of them go to the subterraneans. They pretend to be, they have their whatever UFOs and technology, and they've been exchanging this for probably a couple hundred years. I'm not sure. Definitely since World War II, and I would say World War I, since all the technology has exponentially skyrocketed in terms of advancement, although others have not, like the petro industry. Our cars certainly have not advanced at the rate that our computers have and other things.
Well, that's so, because there was technically a legal limit on how efficient that you can make an engine under US law.
That's right. That's right. To accommodate these so-called extraterrestrials, some call them draconians, Anunnaki, reptilians, and whatever you want to call them. I do believe, because I've researched this and got this from many sources, not just one source. I wouldn't be speaking like this if I only had the one source, but I have many sources that these, the ones that interfere with us come from below, not above. The above entities, they don't interfere. Their laws are different and they allow us free will. And you could say that those are the true gods, the gods that visited us and taught us all the sciences and everything like that. They from heaven fell, or from heaven taught us. So because many did not fall, they're the sons of God that are spoken of that fell. Well, I suppose I don't believe that to be literal, but I do believe that it did manifest ultimately in a literal way, even though it's speaking of literary ways of falling. Falling has to do with losing consciousness and losing contact with cause and falling from one condition to a state. So, or from one condition to another condition, you know, like falling from the fine pan into the fire. That's a fall. And so that's what I believe, and a lot of research is pointing to that. The interferers are coming from subterranean planets, and they're going to be punished for that because they're not supposed to do that. It appears that their survival depends on our survival, and so it's strange that they would threaten us with nuclear destruction and things like that, and have us believe that you know, we could easily destroy this planet, and because all the planets need to be whole and sacred and looked after. You know, we're caretakers. We've been given trust to look after this place. And as we look after it and do it properly, we actually evolve our spirituality and grow and develop to the point where we can leave. We can come and go, actually. We don't have to leave, but we do leave, and we do have that power. We have the power of teleporting, and we have the power of you know, going to other places. And there are many other places, and most of them are stretched out on this plane, you know, beyond Antarctica. This is one of the reasons why, again, why we are not allowed to visit those places, because there are doorways there that are really, really explained very well by a lot of great scientists of the past. These days you don't hear from them because they're belittled and their books are burned and everything like that. But in the past we had many, many accounts of how to get through the firmament and go to other worlds and visit other more benign and beneficent races of people who live longer, who have better science and technology and live in harmony with each other. We have been in a very, very hellish place in the last couple of hundred years, due to the interference from the subterraneans. And so it's high time that we learnt about this, the true nature of our cosmology. And once we do that, then we'll know where our real enemies are coming from, and that they are demonic, and they are not, you know, the people that we see on this plane, you know, from a grassroots organic sort of way of seeing them. We will understand that a lot of the politicians are possessed by demonic entities. You know,
well, the ones that seem to accumulate a lot of power, control, money, sex, and bad relationships. Yeah, you know these people. They're pretty easy to spot. You know, if you just do a bit of digging on who they are, do a bit of verification on people, you'll find that, oh, okay, they screwed this person over, that person over, and so on and so forth. They leave a trail of destruction everywhere they go. But it's the only way to actually find out for sure if somebody's really, I don't know if it's Archon or psychopath or if it's a parasitic entity that it latches onto the lower reptilian brain and then controls the host from then on out. People that come out come out from cults and stuff like that, and their families, like, they're not the same. They're not. That's not my daughter, bro. No.
Yeah. No. You hit it on the head. It's a parasite. I think the beyond demonic, I don't think whether that, well, it is sufficient and it is appropriate to use that expression, because all the scriptures, Bhagavad Gita, all the scriptures refer to them as demons. But really what they are truly is parasites. And parasites come in many, many forms. They are... You know, your body can be full of parasites, and we do have parasites in our bodies. And if we do not look after the pH of our bodies and keep our beautiful biochemical laboratory all nice and alkalized and at 7.3, I think it is, or 7.2, what will happen is we will be overtaken by parasites. You look at all of these obese people, they are full of worms and parasites, tapeworms, all kinds of worms. I've removed them by doing fasts. I've done the Andreas Moritz fast a couple of times, and I've removed many parasites. And these are very, very ugly. They disturb us. They cause us not to sleep. They cause us to react very, very violently to other people. They cause us to have depression. fits of rage. All of these horrible things that you see in human nature can be 99% of it all goes back to parasites.
Might I
in
also fact, say that when you're detoxing, you also exhibit the symptoms that the thing that you're cleansing yourself of is causing?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And so these parasites, they do get under your skin. They do get in there. And I think they are the only thing in existence that really should not be a part of our world. I think we have to start looking at parasites and looking at dealing with them more than any other problem that we have. And I think what you'll find then is if we are able to identify parasites inside and outside, we won't come under their influence and we will, you know, we will fare better. I remember reading somewhere a very, very great article about autism in children after they get vaccinated. Now, why is it that some children have autism and they go into they get paralyzed and they go blue and then some of them die after vaccinations, whereas others, it appears that others don't get any effect at all? Well, due to how many parasites are in these little children. If you bring your child to get vaccinated and they are full of parasites, you can rest assured you're going to have trouble with that child. They will react with the parasites and it will bring great harm to the children. And this is why some people are sicker than other people. It's because of the parasites. They're full of parasites. And especially people, you know, we should look slim and sexy. Human beings should be slim and sexy. We should all be sexy. Really, everyone is, but you know, their attitudes and their behavior and their body shape makes them not to be in the eyes of the beholder. So when I walk down the street, I see very few sexy people these days because I've got a stand.
Uh-oh, I seem to have lost you, Santos, for a second there.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, I pressed the button I shouldn't have pressed. So when you walk down the street and not everyone appears to be sexy to you, there's a reason for that, and that's because their bodies have actually changed from their original form. Their DNA is changing in the wrong way. So what happens is the cell lining gets destroyed and it's not able to bring nutrients into the cell, and so the DNA cannot replicate as it should. And so some people respond by becoming obese. So their DNA, it's in their DNA, you know, and even though they change their diet and try to go on a diet to lose weight, they struggle because now their DNA has been altered. So they're going to have to do a lot of work to really clean the parasites out first and foremostly, and then get their DNA to speak to, you know, their bodies properly by ingesting good food, and then they will restore their bodies to when they were, you know, 18 years old. My body is the same. My body has never, ever changed its shape from when I was a teenager. I still have my teenage body. I've never had a big belly. I've never had any, you know, problem with fat and obesity and overweight. Yes, I'm underweight, that's for sure. That's due to parasites. I've had a problem with parasites, and I think I got them when I went to Vietnam and Thailand in 2008, late 2008. It was then that around 2010 and 9 I started losing massive weight. I was 63 kilos. I went down to 53, where I still am. And so it's really a struggle. Even though I've done a few of these fasts, I still feel that I've got a ways to go. So we all have.
Doesn't it strike you as ironic that fasting sometimes a very slow process?
Yeah. There is a way to kill them for sure. If you did a 10 to 20 day just water fast, you would you'd kill all the unpleasants in the body. In fact, many people have done that and they feel renewed, just totally and utterly renewed. So for any listeners who are struggling with health, You want to restore your health? Have a look at the story of Dr. Sebi. Dr. Sebi is a Honduran doctor who's cured cancer, beat the FDA and the Supreme Court in the 80s. He was brought before the Supreme Court because he used the word cure, and he did that with herbs. And so he won. He won the case. He brought about 80 people of his people who had their papers, who had been cured of cancer, AIDS, all sorts of diseases. And he did that with herbs. Now, how he discovered this was he had arthritis all over his body. He was impotent. He was impotent, arthritis and diabetes, and he was dying. And so he went to this Mexican guy. And the Mexican guy says, right, you ain't going to eat for 3 months. I think it was 90 days, yeah. 30, 60, 90, yep. And he didn't eat for 90 days. He didn't die, and he was cured of impotence, diabetes, arthritis. Now he's in his 80s. He goes all around the world lecturing. He's cured many, many people of all kinds of diseases, and his herbs speak for themselves. He's helped many people in Hollywood, names, I won't mention them. You'll see the names in his videos. He explains how he's helped many, many famous people. And so he's got the track record. Now, he's not the only one that I've heard that has done this. You go on a fast and you starve those parasites to death, and you will eliminate them, and you start again. And this is one way to get your body back to that sexy teenage form that you once had, that your DNAs were trying to bring you to, but we fought against it by polluting our bodies with processed foods. Where in nature do processed foods factor in? Nowhere. Nowhere. Processed foods are what's changing people's DNA and making them obese and sick, very sick. And so the best foods that you can have, of course, are fruit and vegetables. Fruit should be eaten raw, and vegetables should be eaten slightly cooked because of the cellulose, and they're harder to digest. So I'm subsisting on fruit and raw fruit in the mornings. I make juices and just eat apples, all the best organic apples. I only buy organic produce, only, period. I won't buy anything else. And in the afternoons and early evenings, I will have something cooked, like a dal. I make a lot of Indian dals, and I use a bit of rice there as well. And I now believe that for the energy that we're under in this current system, that little bit of cooked food is necessary still. But ultimately, there are raw foodists like Dr. Robert Young, and I believe Dr. Sebi is a raw foodist, and there's many, many great raw foodists who look way, way, way better than anyone who eats cooked food. And so there is a way of doing it, perhaps not for all of us, because you know, we all have our problems. We all have something going on. We have to know our own bodies and go easy. But definitely I would recommend one thing to anyone listening. Do not eat the dead corpses of sentient beings. This is very, very harmful, not only to your physical body, but it is very, very harmful to your eternal, immortal life. Definitely this teaching has come from corrupt service-to-self beings called demons in my book, and they have taught many cultures and indigenous peoples to partake of this. The Indians in the Americas were eating buffalo. The Aboriginals here were eating kangaroos and emus and all kinds of animal flesh. And I'm sure if they go back, way back, they will find that in better ages, in dream time, this did not happen. It can't have happened, because animals are not here. They weren't put here to serve as food. Animals are here to serve as caretakers as well of the earth, and they have a life. They have intelligence and reason, and they have feelings and emotions and personality. And they also are to develop those personalities in their lifespan. And as they do, they also reincarnate eventually as human beings. Not that they are human beings, but the spirit and the soul in them is of human origin. So we are actually killing our brothers when we kill cows and animals. Now, you know, Bhagavad Gita is very clear about this. It says you are a murderer if you partake of this practice. There's no other way to define someone who does this. And they insist that you will reincarnate as an animal and be eaten by an animal to experience what you have done to animals, if you should do that. And so that's the only real one recommendation I always make. And yes, I do get very vociferous about it, and some people get offended, and it's amazing how it really offends some people, and they turn around and want to kill me for giving them the best advice that I could ever give them, because I know that one day, if they remember this advice and apply it, their health will benefit and their everlasting outcome will benefit, and they will be thankful to me and not want to kill me, but want to thank me for giving them the best possible advice I could give to any human being on this plane.
The problem is people don't work that way. If you give somebody good advice, first couple of times they'll say you're stupid, you're crazy, etc., etc. There's a whole long list of names that they call people who tell them things that they don't want to hear, don't want to know, things that might actually cause them to have to change who they are, what they do, how they view themselves, etc., as opposed to simply adopting all the lies and use that to build up a chain of neuroses that they call their personality and their life. So when it comes down to convincing somebody, I found that getting emotionally invested or actually trying to convince them is the exact opposite of what one should do, because it just doesn't work. It's like trying to build a sandcastle on a beach. You know, it doesn't matter how well you build that sandcastle, the waves will always wash it away. It's best to just enjoy it for what it is, make a sandcastle right there, chuck in the information, and then expect to see it just washed away, but enjoy the time that you spent talking about it.
Yeah, it would be nice if our particular manner of teaching, whether emotional or detached from emotion, would work every time you open your mouth and uttered some, you know, helpful advice. But even when you give it to them nice, it doesn't. But the thing is, why do we offer it? Well, it's about accountability, responsibility, and sharing what you know to the benefit of other people, and so that you do not share any guilt that you didn't warn someone. Imagine, you know, you're walking on a near a precipice, and someone's walking in front of you, and you know that it's camouflaged, but there is a cliff, and you know, and you just wait and watch that person fall to their death. You know, you could have said, "Well, I didn't have to warn him. He's got his own eyes. He's got his own intelligence." You know, why? Well, this is when someone opens their eyes and sees the true. Are we going to break?
We'll continue.
Yep.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. This is a listener-supported show, so if you like, you know, a platform that's, you know, non-confrontational and actually just brings people on and just in order to hear them out, if you're tired of all the kind of like being constantly interrupted by ads, etc., then just go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and start donating regularly to the show today. And this is also a listener-supported network that allows us to talk about anything we want. No taboo topics, no fear of doom, right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 2 days a week on The Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's The Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 2 days a week, on the Mondays and the Tuesdays in the United States, and on the Tuesdays and Wednesdays in New Zealand. And if you're listening to the delayed broadcast that we have on a number of our other affiliates, welcome as well. We spoiled the live deception. My very special guest is Santos Bonacci from Australia. Welcome back.
Thank you, Vinny.
Now, where were we just as we got cut off from break there?
Oh, God. I lost it.
Yeah, we were going into some sort of time-space continual lapse. Big Bang. Okay, now, the Big Bang Theory, I think, is one of the other materialist teachings, as you say, which I think was originally postulated by the Catholic Church, who reckoned the Earth was created in a Big Bang by an all-powerful entity anyway. You know, so they postulated a theory that completely suited their worldview. Surprisingly,
yep.
You know, nobody saw that coming, and so they so they adopted it.
Yeah. So, well, with the Big Bang again, it's everything came from nothing, and so this. What they're doing is. They're giving the origin and the glory, you could say, to nothing for creation. Whereas what the Big Bang teaching is a counterfeit of, or what it's trying to show, is that everything comes from invisible causes. And so this is the true teaching, you see, but And that the cause is intelligent. It's an intelligent being, a person. Person comes from person. Life begets life. Intelligence begets intelligence. And so intelligence doesn't grow in a soup. You know, it's not manufactured from nothing. It comes from something, someone in particular. And so this is what the teaching is doing. Not that anyone in their right mind would deny that there is explosive energy that is creative. Well, fire is the creator, the tetrahedron, plasma, radiance. Fire is the generator. And so we already know that the scriptures call God a blazing fire. Jehovah is a blazing fire. In fact, it's Jah-Ram, the Ram, or Jah-Ra, which is Ram, which is Aries, the fire sign in astrology. And so,
and Jah was also known for blazing.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
That's a Rastafarian reference for the uninitiated, by the way.
Yeah, Jah blazing, Jason, Jah's son. Jesus or Jason looking for the golden fleece. It's all about Jah, Jehovah, Jupiter, and it's about fire. And so really what's going on is the creator uses his intelligence and a whole series of little big bangs, which are atomic waves. There's no particles in the atoms. There's no electron particles. They don't exist. They do not exist. It's just waves. It's waves, as Walter Russell taught. And there's even Ken Wheeler teaches, you know, the guy I spoke to in the first hour about magnetism. And so these are little big bangs. There's not one big bang, you know. And if there was, even if there was, they would have to make their theory truthful, they would have to give that the source and cause of that big bang to an intelligent creator, and this is where they fall short. And so it's not a construct, it's a creation. We don't live in a construct, as some people like to say, because they like to steal the glory away from intelligence, intelligence source, and give it to nothing at all, if to themselves. Most of these teachers out, you know, they are stealing the glory from what's due, and giving it to themselves, you know, giving their names to some of these inventions and so-called discoveries. You know, why would you do that? There's nothing new under the sun, and it's already been done. And we don't discover things, we just stumble on them and utilize them. So you'll find it's very difficult sometimes to draw the fine line between what is a materialist pseudoscience theory, a hypothesis like gravity, and what is a transcendental absolute truth. You know, the great teacher Thomas H. Burgoyne, he was very, very careful to warn us of the difference between the two, because he found that many people don't know the difference, even amongst the teachers, you know. And some of the teachers will say things like, "Oh, there is no truth." When I hear that, my blood curdles. It's just disgusting to hear. And they call themselves, you know, they say they're in the truth movement or alternative or independent media. I hate the word media. I mean, I don't consider myself to be in any kind of media. I'm just a truther because I teach truths. So I just am a truther. So this is what he said.
Is a truther someone who teaches truths or searches for it? Or is it both?
Absolutely. You search, you find, you teach and preach.
I found a lot of the things that I've taught people, I don't know, maybe 6 months down the track, maybe even a year down the track, go, "The hell was I thinking?"
I know, because this is where we've been deceived by relative truths or the truths of appearances. I'll read what Thomas Burgoyne says. He says about how to achieve this wonderful understanding of truth. How far back shall I go here? The only equipment that will be found useful and will repay the cost of transportation is an unbiased mind, logical reasoning, genuine common sense, and a calm, reflective brain. Anything else for the voyage upon which we are now about to embark is simply so much useless, costly lumber. Hence, so far as modern science and theology are concerned, the less the student has, the better it is for him. Unless he can use his scientific acquirements merely as aids in climbing the spiritual steps of occultism. If he can do this, then he will find science a most valuable auxiliary force. But this achievement is an exceedingly rare gift and one that is seldom found. It is also the most delusive snare, because 9 out of every 10 seriously cheat themselves into the belief that they possess this ability, whereas in reality they are woefully deficient. Hence it is always a safe course to mistrust the absolute impartiality of our opinions and reasoning.
Yeah, have you ever seen a drunk person say, "Man, I can do this really awesome, just watch this," before they really, really fuck it up?
Exactly. Before starting out on such a mighty and important undertaking, we must draw the reader's attention to the chief obstacle of the voyage, and the one which will have the greatest difficulty, he will have the greatest difficulty in surmounting. This hidden rock upon which so many otherwise profound students of the occult have become shipwrecked in this non-realization of the duality of truth, vis-a-vis the truth of appearances and the truth of realities. The former is relative only, but the latter is absolute. And so, yeah, this is the rocks that I see many are getting shipwrecked on, and 9 out of 10 of the truthers out there, they are in fact half-truthers because they don't understand this, the duality of truth. You know, they've been molded in the education system possibly, where they've been told that everything is relative and there's no absolute truth. Well, that's a crock. That's the biggest lie.
I approached this crossroads myself about how much information do you accept and or whatever, and it's like the simplest method that I've found is simply have a bigger possibility box, right? Just if you can't confirm something, but if you can't like specifically refute it, even though you don't agree with it, but you just haven't taken the time to research into it and then try to debunk it for yourself, just keep it in the possibility box. There's a few things that you do research into and you put them into the definitely not true, which is a very small box. And then there's other things that you research into and that you find that are absolutely true, because you keep repeating the exact same thing every single time with the exact same result.
Yeah. So rather than being filled with the truth of appearances, you are now learned in the truth of realities. And so just a simple illustration, if you put a if you put an orange at arm's reach in front of your face as you look in front of your eyes as you view the moon, and you know, you could say, oh well, look at that, the orange is the same size as the moon, therefore the moon is the size of an orange. Well, in reality this is untrue, but in appearances it's very true. And so most people, their research is so limited, you know. For instance, with the geocentric disc plane model, just to avoid saying flat earth, you know, they look at two or three videos, go 5 minutes in, and then, oh, that's ridiculous. How do I know they do that? Well, because that's what they do to me. And, you know, they say, oh, I couldn't watch more than 5 minutes of that video. Santos, that's ridiculous. It's just pure bullshit. It's ridiculous. Rightio, well, that's where you are, you know, sticking to the truth of appearances, because it only appears that we are turning. And it, you know, when you look up at the sky and you see movement, motion, you naturally attribute it to the spinning globe because we've been told that we're spinning. That's what we've been told. We've been hammered with it, with the globe in the kindergarten classroom. Since then, you know, you look at all the kiddies show, there's always a globe in the corner, always, always, everywhere where kids are involved, there are globes. It's truly a childish kindergarten. It's for children. You know, get them while they're young, they teach. Mm. And so, you
know, there's a Herbert Spencer quote that I think is actually quite relevant here. It says, there's a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation.
Yeah. Condemnation before investigation is the height of folly, said one not very wise man, Einstein. Why do I say that? Well, because as he said on his deathbed, you know, all of his teachings are a castle in the air, really. Relativity, the lot. He said even gravity. He said all of it. It's just a castle in the air. You know, he admitted on his deathbed. Whereas someone like Tesla went to his grave, you know, with great, you know, good conscience and contributed and tried to contribute to mankind, but they blocked him, of course. He was blocked in his efforts.
He did give us TV and radio and alternating current and almost every valuable piece of electronic technology and broadcasting capacity that we have today. So I think he contributed a little something, at least.
A bit more than a little, for sure, for sure. Yes, and he also laughed at two teachings, which are gravity and relativity. He, in particular, he went after those two, as did Walter Russell.
Well, that's ironic, because studies have found that gravity is relative.
Love it. Yeah. And that's grave.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's absolutely true, because I forget where I read it or something, but they were, like, measuring the pull of gravity, right? And they were surprised to find that it just kept changing all the time. You know, not hugely, but it was never the same. It was always different. And so they kind of just said, well, we can't explain why that is, so let's just agree that gravity is a certain thing and that it doesn't change, to simplify it for everybody so that it's easy to understand.
Yes, that's what they're doing. They're not giving answers because they're not allowed to find the answers. They've got certain constraints, you know, their education system, and you know, certain entities will come down upon them. And so there's many reasons why we're not getting the answers, but in the main, they just don't know, you know. So they speculate. You see, they have to start speculating about all these ridiculous speeds that we're doing, hurtling through space and what have you, because they just can't give a simple explanation. Really, it's everything's really, really, really simple. When you go geocentric and you go back to our true organic teaching cosmology, many, many other things just fall into place, many things. For instance, for me, astrology now makes wonderful, complete, perfect sense. I'm able now to, I've leaped into another level of understanding astrology now, that I understand how it works along the ecliptic, and that the sun is basically a 24-hour clock. When you look at your clock, what you're actually looking at, especially if you have a 24-hour clock like the military have, you will understand how everything works. You just have to meditate on the clock. You know, the hour hand, hour comes from Horus, the sun, and min comes from moon, minute, the minute hand. And the second hand is basically dealing with the other fast orb, Mercury. But minute and hour, Horus and moon. And so what you'll find is that in the center, how it's explained in the Vedic cosmology is that in the center of the Earth at the North Pole, which is the center of the Earth, there is a magnetic mechanism. They call it Mount Meru, and it's magnetic, and the color of blue, lapis lazuli. So even if pilots fly close to it, they would never pick it up because it's pretty much the same color as the sky, and so it camouflages in with the sky. But it it is turning at 24 hours every single day, and it is controlling both the moon and the sun, and possibly the other five so-called quote-unquote planets. But what is known about the sun is that it's much further away from the Earth at the Tropic of Cancer than it is at the Tropic of Capricorn. Now, this is a fact whether you are geocentric or heliocentric or whoever you are. Everybody on the planet must subscribe to this, because in all the different various teachings of the cosmologies, they all concur and agree that at the Tropic of Cancer, June 21st through July 4th, Independence Day, those 2 weeks there, that's what they call aphelion. A-P-H-E-H-E-L-I-O-N, aphelion or aphelion. And that is, the sun is further away from the Earth than it is at Capricorn, which is called perihelion, on January 4th. It's pinned to, you know, December 21st and then 2 weeks after January 4th. So there's a two-week period there where the sun is closest to the Earth. Now, in the heliocentric model, they say that it's 3 to 5 million miles closer to the Earth, because, of course, they teach that the sun's 93 million miles away. In the geocentric model, with a dome or a firmament or a vault above the head, our heads, the sun's only about 1,000 to 3,300 miles above our heads. And they've worked it out. They've done scientific tests to prove this. And so there's the varying height sun. Sometimes they measure it at 1,000 miles above our heads. Other times it's 3,300 miles above the heads. And I would say that at Cancer, it is. It's further away, and I would say it's 3,300 miles. And then at Capricorn, it's way, way closer. So, and of course, the circle of Cancer is much, much closer to this Mount Meru. It's a very small circle, whereas Capricorn goes right around the rim of the Earth in a very, very big arc circle. And so this is what stumbles a lot of heliocentrists. They say, well, how can that be? Does the sun increase in speed? Well, no, it doesn't necessarily. It appears to, because it yearly it forms like a teepee pyramidal type vortex pattern. And so the bottom of the vortex, the bottom of the teepee is where Capricorn is, and the top is where Cancer is. And so, and it climbs up 6 months up, 6 months down, up and down this pyramid, like the scarabus beetle does.
Going up and down a pyramid in a spiral rotation kind of pattern.
Yes, a vortex, a hyperbole, a torus. And so it is not actually traveling. It appears to. So if you grab a torch, like a laser torch in your hand, and you turn around and count to 10, and you just do these circles clockwise, right? But you project the torch 5 meters in front of your body. Well, where the light is touching the ground, it's actually going to be doing a circle of about 16 meters, right? Because you multiply the radius, which is 5 meters, by pi, 3.1. That brings you around about 16 meters. But where you are holding the torch standing and just turning around, the torch is only actually traveling at, say, it's only done a circumference of about a meter and a half, not even, okay? So 16 meters out there where the light is reaching, and 1 meter where your hand is, where you're holding the actual torch. And so if Mount Meru was some kind of a clock, it's a 24-hour clock, and it is projecting the sun on this dome structure above our heads at Cancer, well, it's still doing a 24-hour day because the days never change. They're always 24 hours long. But the difference, and this also explains why there's a difference in the duration of day compared to night. In winter, the days are shorter than they are in summer. The summer days are very, very long. Well, there's no way that the ball Earth can actually explain this phenomenon. There's absolutely no way. It's impossible to explain the differential in duration of days through the seasons with a ball model. But you can perfectly well with a round disk Earth and a sun rotating above. You can see clearly why this is. Because the sun acts like a sort of a kind of a spotlight. It just shines, it reflects or shines its light as a spotlight does. And so whatever is outside of the reach of that spotlight is darkness. And I've witnessed this myself. I've witnessed the terminator or the delineator of light when I was flying from Perth to Melbourne in 2002. And everyone in the plane was just gasping. We were all gasping.
There's a little something rolling around over there, like you've got a matchbox car on the desk or something. I don't know what that is.
Oh, I see. I think the cord has been rubbing up against the arm of the chair.
Oh, right. There we go. Sorry
about that.
Continue.
Anyway, so here we are 30,000 feet above the Earth, and I'm flying in late afternoon from Perth to Melbourne. And what I see in front of me for 180 degrees in front of me is darkness, black, dark. And what I see behind me is light. And we look to the left and to the right, and we actually saw the Terminator, everyone in the plane. And besides that, we saw another phenomena. We looked onto the ground, and what we saw arcing for 180 degrees around was a rainbow in the lighter portion behind us in the west as the sun was setting. We saw a rainbow. Vinny, it was incredible. I wish I was smart enough to think, I better photograph this for posterity, and I didn't. And I don't know whether anyone else did, but everyone was just gasping. It was just incredible, the noises you heard from people. A rainbow was standing vertically, arching 180 degrees, and it was pretty thick, actually, rainbow, too. It spanned at least 6 or 7 degrees in height. It was vertical, not horizontal on the flat Earth. It was actually vertically standing upright behind us for 180 degrees. Something which proves also that there can't be any curvature at all whatsoever on this Earth, because although rainbows arc, they do not curve, do they? You see, the spine of the spine of any rainbow is absolutely 100% straight, despite the arch of the colours of the rainbow.
And the ironic usage of the gay movement to use it as their symbol.
Yes. How very funny. But
I just thought I'd pop that in there just quietly.
Yes, yeah, we've got to appease all the people that are listening. So I thought that was quite wonderful, and I will never forget that. That was very special, what I saw, and it will always remind me, because at the time I had no idea. I mean, I was a Jehovah's Witness back then, and of course, they teach, like all the churches teach, the Copernican and Keplerian and Galileo model of a round ball spinning, and they try to actually claim that the Bible teaches this, where it doesn't. It does not. In hundreds of scriptures in the Bible, it teaches that the Lord made the world firm and immovable and stationary and placed it on its pillars, and its four corners have four pillars, and they are firm and immovable, and the Lord dwells above the circle of the earth, not the sphere, the circle, which means it's round. So, and this is another thing. I remember I did see rotundity. I did see rotundity, but I did not see curvature. And what's the difference between round and spherical? Well, is a coin round or is it spherical? Is a disc round or is it spherical? Is a table round or is it spherical? You know, you have a round table, do you not? But it's not a ball. And so I remember seeing that rotundity, but I did not see the curvature. I misunderstood that to be curvature. And how do I know that? Well, it's simple. It's simple. What I remember is this. When I looked to the left, I saw the horizon meeting my eye level. It was in the middle of my window, the horizon, for hundreds of miles. I looked to the right to see if I could see the rainbow in the windows to the right, and I could, when people didn't have their heads in the window, just marveling at the sight. I saw the rainbow coming up to my eye level and the horizon with it, right up there to my eye level. So how can you be 30,000 feet high and you look around an arc of 360 degrees, you look forward, you look back, you look to your left, you look to your right, through all the windows of the plane, and there is the horizon meeting your eye level as though it was in the middle of your window all the way around. Even if the Earth had a curvature, a circumference of 250,000 miles rather than 25,000 miles, add a couple more zeros to it, even if it had that, it would not, the horizon would never come up to your eye level. You'd still see a drop off. And never anywhere do you see any drop off wherever you go. No matter what mountain you climb, no matter how high you fly in a plane, you never see any drop off. So this is another thing that people need to do. They need to understand that what they're seeing is rotundity. And that's acceptable and understandable. But they're not actually seeing drop off in terms of curvature. And there's the big difference.
Now, the last part of the Big Five is evolution. What's your take on that?
Okay, well, evolution, development, growth, that's always happening. It's always happening. In fact, the first four letters of the word evolve is love backwards. And the loving universe is evolving, but it's not evolving in the mechanical Darwinian sense, from nothing to intelligence, from no intelligence to supreme intelligence, because he claims that it's survival of the fittest, and so the fittest are going to be the most intelligent, are they not? They're not the dumbest. So we're going to go from dumb, nothing, stupid, inchoate, unintelligent soup molecules, and we're going to evolve and acquire all of this intelligence, consciousness, love, qualities, and all these other things that just are, you know, side benefit of this magic word evolution. And we were once monkeys, we were once reptilians, we were once all of this other stuff. Well, that's not how it works. You know, the evolution that is occurring through intelligence. Intelligence begets intelligence, and so it works in such a way. And Thomas H. Burgoyne explains it perfectly in his book, The Light of Egypt, Science of the Soul and Stars, Volume 1, where he shows that all intelligent life, such as our lives, comes from seeds. In fact, the sperm of our fathers, and those are invisible. And the egg of our mothers. And so they combine and they are invisible and then they grow. They double and they grow. And inside these seeds are intelligence. And so this growth, this being that is evolving and growing and involving talents and potentialities and growing them and gifts and abilities are coming from an already created seed of intelligence. It's already in the DNA. It's already in the energy of the sperm. It already comes in this cosmic egg. That's what the cosmic egg is all about. And they are little units of intelligence. Everything is seeded this way. A tree, an acorn, makes an oak. You know, and you wonder how that tree, after seeing it evolve and grow from an acorn, you wonder how all of the processes that made it take that form happen. You know, the water, the photosynthesis, the carbon, and all of this wonderful stuff that is going on. It comes from intelligence. It did not evolve from nothing. And so what we have to do now is we have to switch on our spiritual brains, our spiritual minds, grow up, do a bit of meditating and a little bit of reading, and see that there is a very intelligent source and cause of all things. And so when we see different life forms that are extinct and we see the fossil remains of them, we should not assume that they evolved into something else. No. Forms come and go, and they all come from the sun. The sun is the cause of all the forms that we see in the solar system, as all the teachings, even Walter Russell taught this. He says, all the seeds come from the center of the sun, the core of the sun. All the seeds of life and intelligence and form that we see. And so the sun is an intelligent being. In fact, in Kabbalah, it's Michael the archangel. In Christianity, it's Jesus, the sun. And the Father is the dome. The dome above is the Father and the originator of this world, this universe. And there's many of them. There's many of these domes. They are eggs. They are like apples. Taurus fields. You can see these apples. In fact, if you look at the work of Stan Tenen, a Jewish scholar, he's got lots of good videos. He shows how this apple contains a plain flat earth in the middle of it, running perpendicular to its core, and it is a torus field and a hyperboloid at the same time. Look at the apple. You'll see an hourglass in the middle, and the outer skin is the torus. And these are the apples of Apollo. Apollo is an apple. We live in the Big Apple. So this dome really resembles an apple that we live in.
And people don't want to really discuss it because they don't want to upset the apple cart.
Exactly. Exactly. And so rather than stretching their minds and opening their minds and opening their horizons to accommodate these ancient cosmologies and another cosmology other to the one that they learnt in kindergarten, you know, they're doing themselves a disfavor and then by closing their minds, because one day we are going to...
Might I just interrupt you there? Very, very sorry to do this, but there's two ways of explaining things. One is by just saying that you've been lied to, etc., and the other is actually explaining and giving the details.
Yeah, exactly, and supporting it with evidences and proofs and facts. And so what I found anyway a couple of years back when I started getting people sending me all of these flat earth videos and knocking them back and telling them, you know, I know my stuff. I've based all of my syncretism on the true heliocentric model. I know, you know, I read Walter Russell, and Giordano Bruno died because he said the earth was a ball, and so did Galileo Galilei was persecuted, and all of these greats were persecuted. So I know my stuff. But what I found was the lack of evidence to support the spinning ball was just astounding. And in fact, I continue to say, despite others you know, retorting, yes, we've got evidences, which they don't. There is not one evidence, not one, that we live on the globe. You know, Coriolis effect, all of this stuff about the tides and the polar stars doing, you know, bullseye time-lapse star trails and all of this, none of that is evidence. In fact, all of it is evidence to really confirm that whatever shape we're living on, it's stationary. And whatever is moving is not us. It's actually the stars. Now, the George Airy experiment that I explained, mentioned in the first hour, what Airy was doing was he was trying to establish some movement of the Earth, because he thought, well, I wake up in the morning and I don't feel, unless there's an earthquake, I don't feel that we're moving. It just does not feel that we're spinning. You know, there's no high winds. There's no evidence of this 66.6 thousand miles an hour orbiting around the sun and rotation either. It just doesn't make sense. And so he got a telescope, and what he did was he tilted it to accommodate the light rays coming in and going straight through the center of his telescope. And so he figured, right, if we're moving, I can detect that if I fill the telescope up with water, because then the light rays are slowed down and you'd have to tilt it because you're moving, so you'd have to scoop up those light waves by adding further tilt to the telescope. And so what he found was he filled his telescope and the light was penetrating straight through the telescope without having to adjust the angle, which indicated to him and proved that we are not moving. Because if you're moving, you have to accommodate the slower light waves now and you have to tilt further, right? But he didn't have to. It stayed the same. The light waves penetrated the telescope from the start to the end of the telescope perfectly and completely without any alteration in the wave. And so he called it, or it was called, Airy's failure, because he was out to prove that we moved and he failed. And that experiment is known today as Airy's failure. And besides, many have claimed that Newton was prompted to come out with his relativity theory to actually counteract Airy's failure, the Michelson-Morley and the Sagnac experiment. And so this is how they countered the surmounting evidence that that we're not moving. So regardless of whether you want to call it a disc or a plane or flat or whatever, the fact is I think we should be all focusing on this one point. Are we moving or are we not moving? And how do you tell, and how do you work this out? Well, I've got another way of doing this, Vinny, if you'll allow me.
Yeah, go for your life, son. What else is my show for?
Yep. Well, the other way I explain this is the star trails of the North Pole. Now, a lot of people have filmed on their time-lapse cameras these beautiful bullseye star trails. Perfect, perfect. All centered around Polaris. Now, that's what they do now is they see these star trails and they deduct that we're spinning. Well, yep, that can describe the spin on the axis of the Earth, but it doesn't account for the orbit. See, we're actually orbiting as well as spinning. So there can't be a bullseye if there's an orbit. So if we are really spinning, well then, scientists are lying that we're orbiting. So we'll have to choose, we'll have to be, you know, pick and choose there, because yes, it does suggest that there is something spinning on an axis. Either the axis is Polaris, the North Pole, or it's the North Pole of our Earth. And here's where it gets really, really curly for the globalists or the ballers, people who believe they live on a ball.
The heliocentrics.
The heliocentrists. There you go. And that is, you can only get that effect if you're standing right at the North Pole. Because if you're standing in, say, Canada or Italy or anywhere other than the North Pole, you won't get a bullseye. You will actually get as more of like a sine wave, a wave of star trails. They'll be going all over the place. They won't be curling back into themselves around an axis. So really, all you're doing when you're looking at those, you can Google image, there's hundreds of them. You can even see videos of them. They actually they vary the speed of it so you can see it in fast motion. And you can see these time-lapse star trails, and they're right, very incredible. It's just beautiful to behold. But obviously, there is an axis involved in this effect, and it's not the Earth's, because you have to be at the North Pole to get this effect. And so there's another way of proving conclusively. Of course, George Airy, in his day, he did not have time-lapse cameras, did he? Those cameras were very primitive in his age, so he did what he could. He used a telescope. But should he have had that as a further added evidence, he would have, back then, he would have confirmed it and just made it so conclusive that we wouldn't be arguing about it still in this modern age. And so I always point to that because that is the most beautiful and eloquent and simplex way of showing that we can't possibly be spinning. We cannot be even spinning, let alone rotating, and let alone wobbling and hurtling and, well, what's the other, how can you explain or describe the other movement of the galaxy hurtling through space? I don't know.
Well,
you
there
know,
was Cliff High from halfpasthuman.com says that the sun is traveling around the Milky Way center kind of like a comet, and we're trapped in a spiral sort of undertow trailing behind it.
Yeah, that's what I used to teach. I know Nassim Harriman teaches something like that. I know Walter Russell was leaning towards that, and there are a lot of followers of Walter Russell that are teaching this. But again, they don't have any way of giving evidence. There's not one evidence to support this. It appears. This is the truth of appearances. It's not the truth of reality. And the first illustration and example I gave you of the parallax of the stars confirms that that can't be. It simply can't be.
I was thinking more along the lines of if it's holographic in nature, the hologram would appear the exact same from every viewpoint, not unlike the... There's a scene in, I think it's Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, where they've got a camera behind a projection screen, and the camera lines up with the viewpoint of the person that it's the guard that it's pointing at, and it projects an image from exactly his eye line back at him.
Yep. Well, that's also doable, but it needs research, it needs work, proof, and evidence as well. Whereas this model here, which agrees with science, it agrees with all of the ancient cosmologies bar none, and it agrees with all the modern research that has been done. And there's so many great researchers now. We're so blessed to have so many researchers on this subject that are showing evidences day by day. I have personal friends that have been doing this for a couple of years now. Some of them are Hare Krishnas, others are not. And what is happening is that evidences, one after another, are just stacking up, and they are stacking up and mounting and showing that perhaps they were right 500 years ago. And it shows why it was resisted, in particular in France. The French truly resisted Newtonian gravity theories and the globe more than any other nation.
But in typical French fashion, as soon as it came to a fight, they lost.
Yeah, they start the fight and then pick a fight and then lose it. Yeah, well, they did. They succumbed to it. Everyone did. Even the greats like Giordano Bruno did. And I did. I based all of my information on it. And what I'm doing now with syncretism works much more simply and succinctly and flows better with the heliocentric model. So I do believe that it is all systems are heliocentric because they are terra firma. And there's another hint, terra firma, and then above is the firmament, all of these firm structures. See, when you see planets, so-called, and stars and suns and moons moving in relation to you, well, that gives you the impression that there is movement and there's everything is not firm and stationary and all parts are moving. But it doesn't have to be that way. Not all parts have to be moving. For instance, in a watch, the casing of the watch is not moving, but inside there are gears and cogs and mechanisms and jewels and stuff that are moving.
Yeah,
and
just
they have
like
to
when you
to
see
cause those hands to move. And so it's in a similar way that we can look at this egg, this sphere that we live in. We live inside us. 10 spheres, actually. There's the sphere of Pluto, then Neptune, then Uranus, and then the seven visible planets. And those are spheres in that they have, you know, circular orbits or appear to go around in their orbits, and they do. And this gives us the impression that everything else does. And yet, when you look deeper into it, you will see that this is not the case. It is absolutely not the case. And so when you have to come down to the fact that either one or the other is moving and not both, then it's much, much simpler and easier to grant movement to the skies rather than to the earth. Because if the earth is moving, then we're going to have to reconsider all those time-lapse North Pole images of the star trails, and we're going to have to factor in some orbit there somehow, or we're going to have to ask how is it that you can get that effect when you're not standing at the axis of the Earth, the North Pole. And so there's something really, really wrong with that picture.
Well, the other question is the scientific method, because if you're going to be going around with this sort of information, astrophysics, mathematics, these things sort of come into play, and it is very difficult for the layman to work this one out. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Maybe you're on mute or something.
If such is the case, well, I'll just continue on and wait from you.
I was. Okay.
I can't hear you for some reason, Vinny.
Okay, just go then.
Can now.
You can now?
Good. Yep.
Oh, my goodness. All right, that's fantastic then. I was thinking about this. We don't have a whole lot of technical expertise. For example, I didn't do terribly well at mathematics in school, didn't do terribly well at science. I mean, I didn't fail at those topics. But when people start talking about like fractions and numbers and thousands of miles an hour and millions of miles away from us, etc., the average person, maybe even including me to some extent, just suddenly just because we just don't have the technical expertise to even understand or comprehend the scientific method that's actually necessary to do the calculations, let alone comprehend them. This lends it to being a trust issue. Who do you trust? Who's the information do you trust? Who's got the expertise, etc.? And in today's world, we've known for a long time that if somebody's a professional, the chances are that they're a brainwashed liar to a large degree on many facets. This generalization tends to be true, because a lot of the hierarchical power structures and hereditary institutions of our time have made sure that that is the case, that people don't know what they're talking about, can't sort out the truth for themselves. And what's problematic even further is that we don't know how to make those calculations for ourselves. And this is the reason why the movement starts to get a bit more hostile towards each other, is because you're basically talking about two groups of people that have a very, very fixed worldview. And they, certain groups within those will attack viciously the other side, whereas I found the majority tend to be perfectly reasonable. And if you can come up with evidence to debunk what they're saying, the reasonable ones will actually incorporate it into their new and current understanding. Now, we appear to have lost Santos right here at the towards the end of the broadcast. Going to try and get him back and endeavour to do that right away. But in either case, it's good to see that we can talk about such a contentious issue, which most people deride straight away and not even think twice about whose feelings get hurt or what is, in fact, provable scientifically. This is why I've got a very big possibility box, as I mentioned earlier, because let's face it, we live in a world where most of the major institutions that are in control and of great influence tend to be shilling us BS most of the time anyway. So why should the shape of the earth be any different? What difference would it make to somebody who already has that mindset that there's, let's say you already believe that there's an all-powerful creator. You already believe that most of the institutions and the scientific teachings and spiritual teachings and medical teachings, legal teachings, etc., are all BS anyway, and you don't believe a thing NASA says. In your daily life, would the Earth being flat or not actually make a real tangible difference in the way you live your life? The answer is it doesn't really, but for some reason, people take the issue very seriously, choose to attack each other and not listen. You know, this is why fights keep going on. In any kind of relationship, any kind of movement, as we try to attach labels to people, these are flat earthers or they're globalists, etc. It's very, very hard to accept new points of view and evidence that is contrary to your previous findings, right? But sometimes if you have enough faith in your own worldview, you'd be more than happy to entertain something that is contrary without believing in it right away, but be able to sieve through the evidence, spend a bit of time. A lot of people just say, oh, no, I don't have the time. I don't have the time to figure out what I live on. You know, maybe that's why this debate still goes on. Neil deGrasse Tyson says it's pear-shaped, which I also believe because, mate, if you have a look at the news, everything seems to be going pear-shaped. Oh, crack me up. I do. Santos, welcome back. Santos, are you there? Oh, Nazi. That's very unfortunate. We seem to have been having some very technical issues. Maybe you've got a mute button on your end there, Santos, perhaps?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Beautiful.
We have less than a minute to wrap up, so you better be chucking out your references and videos for people to watch, etc., so that they can catch up on more of this stuff. And he drops out again. That is Attila the Hunfortunate. So, universaltruthschool.com is Santos Bonacci's website, ladies and gentlemen. Go and check that out, and also have a look for Santos Bonacci on Facebook. He's very active on there. A lot of posts and discussions going on. So that'll be good for everybody involved, I believe. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We survive on your donations so that we don't have to stuff your face full of advertising and products that you don't actually really need right now. Thank you very much. We'll see you again sometime.